Right, so I'm going to talk to you about complexity and death, and the actual physics bit is explained here. So in one sense, the reason why this is an appropriate memory talk is that I'm going to talk about something that Memform did not focus on, but could have focused on, which is erasure. Oh, light off. No, I can do the direct a bit. It's okay?
Yes, thank you.
I can do that bit. I now apply for his job. Right. So if one wants to talk about memory, one has to think a bit about erasure. And you know, after all, having a photographic memory could be a very bad thing because you clock up the whole memory system. So, I mean, I've always been fascinated by this thing, heard of it. And, you know, one could have had a talk on this if one could find a good speaker on this. Landau's principle, Rolf Landau, said in 1961, said, if there's no information erasure, then in principle you can carry out computation in a thermodynamically totally reversible kind of way. But only if there's no information erasure. It will take you forever because you need to be quasi-static, but nevertheless, in principle, you can compute without increasing the entropy of the universe. However, if you want to forget, then Landau proved that, proved a theorem that says if you want to forget, it will cost you k log 2 amount of entropy per bit forgotten. But I mean, that's interesting, that's fundamental. This is a sort of second law of thermodynamics for computing. Okay, so he says forgetting inevitably is costly. So,
what is key there?
Sorry?
What is key there?
Temperature. You can erase information at no cost at zero temperature.
You cannot.
You can, because T is zero. But you can't reach T equal to zero in a finite number of steps, so you bug it anyway. So, I mean, T equals zero is not relevant, although it's principally true. I mean, it has an exact method with the second law, from that point of view. Or second and third law. It tells you, you can only break even. You can only break even at absolute zero, and you can't reach absolute zero. It's first, second, and third law. Right? Okay, so I'm going to talk about things where the loss of form is equivalent to erasing memory. But in some sense, the summary of what I can talk about is that it is worth reflecting on the physics of why it is worth doing incomplete erasure. Okay? And this would be a unique talk in the history of KRTP, I'm sure, because there will be no results. I'm making a programmatic statement and trying to persuade you that there is an area of quite coherent phenomenology that physicists may want to come together and think about. Okay, so this is a proto-grind application. So complex systems, let's think about complex systems. So by complex system, I mean a system which with many interacting degrees of freedom. Where many, for physicists, means three or more, because, you know, one is boring, one is philosophy, two is undergraduate physics, three is chaotic, and four is just hopeless. So, you know this, this slide was for a general audience. By the time you get to three in the interacting equations of motion, in general, they're not solvable, and analytically, and we can expect chaos. So, of course, relevant depends on the phenomena we want to understand. So what I'm trying to say is that actually the moment is right for physics to seek a multidisciplinary convergence in thinking about what does it mean for a complex system to die. So in terms of the engineers have been thinking about it for a long time. Engineers have been thinking about quite a while in an era called the product end of life engineering. You know, it basically the train of thought is if you want to recycle your milk carton, what you do not do is to put a sticker on it that is made of a different plastic, because you only curse yourself at the end that you have to peel it off in order to recycle it, so you should have thought about it at the beginning. So if you want to, you know, if you want to think about recycling, you have to think disassembly thoughts right at the start. You've got to build it in. No point cursing yourself at the end and say, I should have thought of it. It turns out that biologists have been thinking about death for a long time, and in particular in a phenomenon called programmed cell death in the context of evolution, which I will tell you about. So I will tell you about these two areas. And then I will contrast it with the current situation in physics, where actually there's no coherent physics thinking on this kind of stuff. Okay? And I'm going to make a case that actually we're ready to think about it, and if we start thinking about it, putting the three together will be incredibly powerful in some kind of new death science. Finally, we can all be Dr. Deaths. This thing is not working very well. Right. Okay, so let me take you to engineering first. This is the shorter third of the talk. It makes sense. Third should be all the same. But anyway, this is the shorter third of the talk. So engineers, a lot of engineers study the failure of complex systems. If anyone of you know what that branch is called, I'd like to know. It's not called failure engineering, for obvious reasons. But a lot of them do. I mean, does any engineer know? I mean, what do you call your colleagues who study failures in particular? Because there are loads of them.
They're involved in engineering.
Oh, I like that. You're taking the spirit of this talk. Well, this is a bit of harmless fun. Right, fine. So, engineering. No, I like that. So, the key point there, of course, is that when you make a system more complex, when there are more interacting degrees of freedom, it fails in more and more surprising ways. And if you're not living in it, the surprise becomes even interesting. When you're in it, you don't. You know, it's not very interesting. Right, so go back to Edison's light bulb, okay? Edison's light bulb had one degree of freedom, one relevant degree of freedom. It's the filament. He knew before he built it how it would fail. The filament would burn. He didn't do any experiment. He knew that was the challenge. There's only one challenge in the end, how to make the filament last longer. Okay, so it's a simple system. It has one relevant degree of freedom. That thing burns. Entirely predictable. Mind you, the Edison light bulb that has been continuously on since he made it in a fire station somewhere in some little town in America. You look it up on the web, you see firemen lovingly caressing this light bulb and cleaning it. They leave it on all the time. So, you know, that one degree of freedom has not yet failed. Now let's go to the halogen lamp. The halogen lamp is not desperately complicated. It has a very hot filament. I'll tell you why very hot in a moment, in a glass envelope with some iodine vapor or bromine vapor. That's it. I mean, that's not that much more complex than Edison's light bulb, right? You've got to admit, the only real difference is the presence of the iodine vapor. Okay? It's not that much more complicated. But let me tell you, even the system, as little more complicated as the light bulb, already has a totally unexpected mode of failure. So this light bulb needs an incredibly hot envelope, because what happens is, what you want is the tungsten to evaporate. I mean, this is actually a movie, okay? So the tungsten evaporates, it reacts with the iodine to make tungsten diiodide, the vapor phase. If the envelope is too cool, it condenses on the envelope, and then yields the iodine back to the vapor phase and coats the envelope with tungsten. There's no point in tungsten. You can do that quite effectively in your own light bulb without a halogen, right? So what you want is the envelope be incredibly hot, so that if tungsten iodide condenses on it, it immediately drives it back to the vapor phase. It doesn't condense. So that it then condenses back on the cooler parts of the filament, dissociate back in iodine in the vapor phase, the tungsten can have a chance to diffuse back to the rest of the filament eventually to make it, you know, thin less quickly. That's all fine. That's what the pattern says. However, this does need an incredibly hot envelope. And now you put your greasy finger on it. Envelope's very hot. It burns. It burns to give soot. I mean, they knew that. Didn't think that was a problem. But there is a problem, because soot nucleates at high temperature, nucleates the amorphous silicate to crystallize. And you know perfectly well the crystal has a lower volume than glass. So it goes bang. Now that was not a design feature. I mean, they didn't design it, and so let's see how well we can get them, you know, with fingerprints. I mean, they didn't know it was going to happen. That's an unexpected failure mode. You can see why we need engineers, because you really do have to think about this, because, you know, especially around this neck of the woods, you get sued when that kind of things happen. You know, and so my message is the system doesn't have to get very much more complicated before failure modes get interesting and unpredictable and potentially disastrous. And of course, when you get the complex system, this is a second order complex system, because it has, you know, this kind of complex system, which we talked about, and you have this kind of complex system, which is the next bit, and they interact. And so then eventually you get that kind of failure most. And this is, you know, not a joke. Okay? So, in fact, if you ever see this book in a second-hand bookshop, buy it. It will only worry you for the rest of your life. But it's a great read while you're reading it. And then you worry about it afterwards. But I mean, this guy, I think he's not even an engineer. He has to be a physicist. You know. I think he might even be a sociologist. I can't remember what he is. But his students, each graduate student, get a failure to study. You know, go and look at Long Island, or, you know, in detail, you know, what actually happened, how one thing led to another. One of the best stories is someone started, this is long before they regularly drill sideways. But they didn't know in those days that drills can in fact go sideways, and go sideways a long way. They empty an entire lake, and they drill into the bottom of the lake. And then this poor man was fishing on the lake, and he said, oh, funny, the water's going down. And there's all this fish all completely lying around him. It was a great day. Anyway, amazingly, no life was lost. A lot of fish was lost, but no life was lost. So, you know, he documents how... Sorry? Well, the fish died because all the water goes. All right. I think that was the most incredible accident that he reported. You know, again, it wasn't intended. You're drilling a hole, you want to go straight downwards, but, you know, somehow you entered a lake over there, and it just, you know, not meant... And in fact, all the water went back later through the same hole. It goes out, and it goes back in. Anyway, so that book is worth reading. Okay, so why is all this relevant? Well, it's relevant because at the moment, our economy is basically what is known as a linear economy. Okay, so we make, we use, we dispose. So then, of course, in this kind of economy, there's a concept of planned obsolescence. So in other words, we want to build in failure. You know, don't leave it to chance that someone may drop the light bulb. Let's build it in. So in fact, incredibly, there was a paper just before the Great Depression really set in, ending the Depression through planned obsolescence. So this guy says, why don't we actually teach engineers to deliberately build in, he wasn't even an engineer, he was an economist. So he said, why don't we actually build in failure? Because then we can have full employment. And you can tune the employment level by figuring out how by making light bulbs that last shorter and shorter. Yeah, they didn't do that during the Great Depression. They didn't think of it. And there was a famous case, and those of you who live here may know that there's a famous cartel of light bulb manufacturers during that period that led to a famous court case because they basically fixed light bulb time to 1,000 hours. When the fact is, there is an Edison light bulb that is still burning now tells you that they can do a whole lot better than 1,000 hours.
Yes.
That kind of thing. I mean, this is well known. This is well known. Okay. I mean, of course, there's a second reason for disposal, and that's because everybody else has got iPhone 8. But that, I'm not talking about that. But that is not even economics. That's psychology. Okay. So I'm going to talk about this bit. Okay. Yes, it needs a plural. Yes, you spotted it. Okay, so we're talking about circular economy here. So what we're now talking about, at least not we in general, you know, there's a lot of people in the world are talking about moving to the case of a circular economy, not a linear economy. Whoops. Where if you really want to do this, then you want to do product of life engineering. I really like that word. Let's get into the next OED. Right, so in other words, if you want to do this bit, you want to think about this bit now. Not by the time you get to here and say, well, I should have thought about it. And that's what you teach engineering student now. Think about it now. What are you going to do? So, this thing is not changing. What am I going to do about this? Right, let's move this a little bit. Okay. I'm going to push this a little bit that way. Oh, that's better. Right. I was very proud of myself for a bit for inventing the phrase active disassembly. The internet is a great equalizer of the ego because, you know, when you're very proud of yourself, you type it in, you say, actually, you know, I've been talking about it for years. So it turns out the engineers, the particular group of engineers, have been talking about active disassembly for a long time. And so they do this thing using memory polymers. Here's the second time the M word comes about. So so there's this paper, it's quite an incredible paper. This is an Institute of Physics journal, amazingly. There's a journal called Smart Materials and Structure, where they did this. Both the screw and the thing that the screw screws into, whatever the thing is called, are made of polymethylene methacrylate. They just make one black and one clear so that you can see it. So you put the screw in, and then what you do, you can heat this thing up to 130 degrees, I think. The screw loses its thread. So you want to disassemble it, you just turn it upside down, let gravity do the rest, and the thread falls out. But you cool it back down, screw threads magically reappear. They don't have those photos, but the screw thread magically appears. It's a memory polymer, which is kind of incredibly cute. And in fact, Nokia has taken it to an extreme. They have made one Nokia 5510 phone that does self-disassembly. If you heat it up, more than body temperature, hopefully, right? You can, in fact, keep it in your pocket without this happening. I think it needs a three-figure number of degrees Celsius for this to happen. It falls apart into the printed circuit board, the liquid crystal display, the cover, and the batch. So that's what engineers currently call active disassembly. It is active. You need to, I mean, it's energy dissipative. You have to put a Bunsen burner underneath it. But it is certainly disassembly. Okay, so engineering is going that way, and the point of doing all this is the circular economy. What they seldom do is think about how to reassemble this. There's no point reassembling this back to a Nokia 5510, because the point is the reason why someone threw it away because they want Nokia 55511. Okay, so what they don't have is mutation and evolution, which is where biology comes in. Okay, so but you know, if you want a circular economy, you do have to think about the next bit. Because, you know, this is okay, but it's not great. Because I don't actually want to remake this, because otherwise it's kind of pretty stupid to make it fall apart and then remake the same film. Okay? But there are people, there are now economists, who are actually modeling the circular economy. So, you know, here's resources, here's products, here's consumption, here's waste, here's recycle, and there are various cost functions involved. I mean, this is the sort of thing that STEM Mac people do. You know? Thinking about how these things work and why it is worth doing and how to retain all the parameters. And if you put a layer of evolution on this, in other words, you let it tune itself, then a biology comes out. Okay, so that's the engineering context. The engineers have been thinking about what they call active disassembly for a while, and the economy certainly would like them to loop it back. So, well, what about the next bit? Okay, how do I make the iPhone 8 after I've active disassembled the iPhone 7? They haven't got anywhere close. Okay. So at the moment, that Nokia phone falling apart is merely for recycling, because you know you need to recycle the LCD display differently from the printed circuit board. But that's not great. They're nothing. So biology, let me start the biology thing by asking an apparently silly question. So I want to start a new campaign for real death. What's special about real death? Biological death. So, you know, is there a Turing test for real death? Like Turing test for real intelligence? You know, how do I get a computer to pretend to be intelligent? How do you get a computer to pretend to die properly? You know, because when we say, it has certain simplicity to this, it's slightly less scary. I mean, when I say my computer died, I don't mean that. I mean, everybody knows I'm using a metaphor. I mean, that's a fact. Okay? I mean, I don't bury it. You might find the next picture disturbing, but I found it in a newspaper. But when that happens, that's real death. I mean, everything about it, from physics through biology to literature, to on every level, is different. So the question is, can I do a Turing test? I mean, the reason why I need to do a Turing test is because I don't understand what it is. The reason why I need a Turing test for intelligence is because we don't understand what it is. We don't have an equation for it. You know, once you have K log W, I don't need a Turing test for disorder. You know, before Boltzmann, you need a Turing test for disorder. You get 10 people and say, is this room in the mess or not? Right, but now you can calculate a number, you don't need a Turing test for disorder. We need a Turing test for intelligence, we need a Turing test for death. Okay, but there's no doubt that when a computer died, the panel would say this is not real death. There's no doubt when a baby gorilla died, the panel would say this is real death. So the question is, where's the line? Can we quantify? Can we say why it is so? So that's a special kind of complex system because it can die in a very special way. That's a perspective. Think about complex systems that is not often used. You know, people tend to think about complexity, you know, common goal or whatever your favorite thing is, whether you can compress it if you're, you know, Levine and Chaikin. But, you know, what kind of complex systems can die convincingly? It's an interesting physics question, I think. Now, of course, biology does not understand the death of those systems. So Lynn Margulis, who is one of the most distinguished biologists of the last century, said, for all the accomplishments in molecular biology, we still can't tell a live cat from a dead cat. The fact is, it doesn't matter if you want a cat genome, whether you sequence the genome of a dead cat or a live cat. I mean, not a long dead cat, because there's a problem, but a freshly dead cat, you sequence the genome, is exactly the same genome as a live cat. Okay, so biology does not understand, and to a certain extent right now, doesn't even care about organismal death. I tell you who cares about it, doctors. Because a lot of modern biology is about genotype. Doctors are paid to deal with phenotype. And death is one of those phenotypes they would rather not have to deal with. Okay, so doctors know about death. Biologists seldom study organismal death. Neither do they often study organismal life. Okay. Whoops. There's a last sentence on there. I don't know what it is. No. What does it say? Right. But it turns out there is significant progress on studying the death of a cell. So let me from now on talk to you about death of cells. It turns out, by the way, I don't have time to talk about this now, but it's actually incredibly difficult to kill cells. There are constantly embarrassed statements and footnotes, which is now been gathered in the book called something like the cell is a gel or something, where you rip the cell membrane and nothing happens. The cell looks back and says, yeah, see if I care. There's a paper where they took a big AFM tip, jab it right through a bacterium and take it back out again, the bacterium just divided into daughter cells in front of the eyes of the experimentalists. The see if I care thing. Yeah. So, I mean, it's actually, there's some circumstances which is actually incredibly difficult to kill the thing. But anyway, there's tremendous progress in thinking about progress of death, the progress in thinking about death at the cellular level. Okay, so, I mean, I'm assuming that none of you have webbed hands or feet. Is that correct? I mean, we hear plenty of those at night because they're frogs. But we're not frogs. We don't have those. And the reason why we don't have those is not because we never had it. It turns out that we all started life isomorphic to a frog. When we were in an embryo form, all of us had webbed fingers and feet. That's the photo of a human embryo. I can't remember whether this is the forelimb or the hind limbs, but it's either finger or toes. But at some point, the cells that form the web committed suicide while you're still in mummy's womb. Those cells were programmed to die, and they're programmed to die in a very specific way that I'll tell you about in a moment. And that's why we don't have webbed fingers and feet. And toes, but if the relevant genes go wrong, you are born with webbed toes or fingers. So this process is called programmed cell death, or PCD. You can tell we're getting close to biology because acronyms start appearing. It's not proper biology yet because only three letters. The real thing has four letters. Sometimes a lowercase. Anyway, okay. So it turns out, I've just told you this, is essential to normal embryogenesis. And it turned out that embryologists have known about PCD for a long time, just they didn't have a name for it. We were talking with Lillian earlier about what is obvious. I mean, to them it's obvious. Of course it has to happen, you know, because we're not born frogs. So they didn't tell anybody. But when the other biologists discovered it, they thought it was terribly exciting. So it turns out that in you, if there hasn't been about 10 to the 12, basically, it's more than 10 to 11. So let's just one terror number of programmed cell death in you today, you are in deep trouble. About 10 to the 12 cells in you needed to have committed suicide today. And these cells generally are cells that have been damaged beyond repair. They do the decent thing.
What fraction of the mass of us is in that?
Yeah, I knew someone was going to ask me that moment I said it, but I've forgotten. Anyone know what the total number of cells in us?
How much does
a
cell weigh?
It's about 100 picogram. A bacteria is a picogram. So our cells is about 100 times bigger. Maybe 10, 50 times bigger, so you can work it out. Tell us at the end, Tom. Well, we'll work it out at the end. And so, it is well known that one of the dangers about cancer cells is that they evade the programmed cell death pathways. Cancer cells are cells that have gone wrong, and they do not commit suicide. And so that's in...
cubic centimeter.
We have a cubic centimeter of cells?
That die.
A cubic centimeter that die. So, a whole eyeball pops a day, right? I mean, it's like popping an eyeball a day, right? That's how much. Right. Before I go any further, let me point out a feature to you that turned out it was going to recur. In embryogenesis, it's kind of curious because, you know, it bothers to make the web first and then destroy it. Because it was designed by human engineer, probably, just why don't we just not make it in the first place? Now, of course, engineering does that too. In order to pour concrete, you need a form, which you get rid of later. So, you know, there may be perfectly good design reason why you need to actually design in the process or make it first and then get rid of it, because maybe it's about tissue instability, you know, the instability in the thing. If you want to form these things, you need all the webs for the thing not to grow out like this, and then later, you know, there's all that, but I haven't seen physicists think through this problem. Why is it worth constantly doing this, you know, make some more material, make some cells, and then you destroy them later? I mean, but, you know, there's treadmilling in a system. And the disassembly is active, it turns out. So the point is that this process, sometimes it's because it's to get rid of mistakes, misfolded protein. But quite often it isn't. I'll come back to the point. And it isn't case, and it's actually particularly interesting. And it's almost always dissipative. So this is a time-lapse movie of some human HeLa cells committing suicide. I'll leave you to think what would be a suitable composer of music to put music to this. Sorry? That is a big cell. That's many tens of microns. The original has a soundtrack, but some person speaking. They do blabbing amongst other things, for those people who know what blabbing is. But for those who don't, that is blabbing.
Forming a raspberry.
Yeah. It's a good word, blab. I mean, it is.
So Wilson, HeLa cells, I mean, they've done something to induce cell production in these cells. Well, what was done?
Can we come to it? I can't know what it's done in here, but I'm going to tell you something about how you might.
So this was done spontaneously by the cell, wasn't it?
So apoptosis, this process is called apoptosis. It's a Scottish thing. One of them is Australian, but he was visiting Scotland, so it's definitely a Scottish thing. He contrived to be a Scottish thing. It's still a Scottish thing. I mean, occasionally, interesting things are done in Scotland outside Edinburgh. This is one of those occasions. Yeah? Right, but this is extremely unusual because there's a footnote in this paper that not only tells you why it is named that, but precisely how you should pronounce it. Because PT is a phoneme in Greek. It's a silent P with the T pronounced, so this should be apoptosis, because ptosis in Greek means falling off, apo means from, so this is falling from. They had electron micrographs, and they showed these electron micrographs to the professor of Greek in Aberdeen, who said, oh, this looks just like petals falling off a flower. I'll leave you to decide whether that movie looks like petals falling off a flower. These are the blebs of the petals. So he said, let's call it apoptosis. But most people say there's apoptosis, and it says, no, it isn't, it's apoptosis. Is a silent P. So I don't know of any science word, but at the moment of birth, it actually tells you, when they christen the baby, it'll tell you how to pronounce the baby's name. It's just kind of cute. It's a unique footnote. Anyway, so this is apoptosis. You want to practice, it's apoptosis. After me, 1, 2, 3. Apoptosis. So your next excuse now, you know how to pronounce it. There's no pop, okay? It's not popcorn. Right, so this is the original drawing. The original drawing is still incredibly worthwhile. What it shows you is that if this cell decided to commit suicide, come back to what might may not tell it to commit suicide, but if this cell decided to commit suicide, what it does is that it breaks itself into fragments that are maximally easy either for the neighboring cells or for red or white blood cells to eat it, phagocytosis. That's non-trivial. Because, you know, if someone mugs me and stabs me in my liver, you know, I say liver, so this happens in liver a lot because, you know, we drink and we do all kinds of nasties. The liver is to get rid of poison. So a lot of liver cells get damaged, so a lot of liver cells have to commit suicide. So liver is a relevant organ. So if someone stabs me in my liver and I miraculously survive, and when I eventually pops, and they do a post-mortem on me, there will be a big scar in my liver. That's because if you kill cells violently, it's not because they decided to die, the products induce inflammatory response. It's nasty product. It's real junk. and junk is never good. Okay? So when a cell evolves to actually kill itself, it knows exactly what it's doing. And that process is hugely organized and hugely dissipative. It's consuming ATP like there's no tomorrow, because there is no tomorrow. And that's the point. I mean, that's the one time when you're allowed to consume ATP like there's no tomorrow. Okay? So it's dissipative and it's highly organized and it's evolved for the product. And that's why, other than embryologists, other medics and biologists have not discovered it. Because you never know what has happened. You blink, it happens. And so, well, what happened? But it's clean. You know, there's a tiny hole, and another cell goes through it, but there's no scar. And so they keep missing it. There's leaf no scar. So necrosis is the other dead processes of cells, they leave scars. So here's one possible answer to Peter's question. It turns out that for a lot of cells in a lot of tissues, I say that because this is biology, there are bound to be exceptions, so now, you know, real, and any real biologists in the audience? So I can say anything like, but I usually say it carefully, because just in case it's a real biologist, because it's bound to tell me there's anything. It's bound to the exceptions. Okay. Anyway, in many tissues, each cell receives a signal from all the other cells that we love you, really, please don't die. And if you just take it out without doing anything to it and put it in a petri dish, it will just die. It will decide to commit suicide because it's feeling lonely. Okay, so, I mean, it's that important. It's not all tissues, not all cells, not all the time. When you're taking it out, you can do things to it to persuade it not to do that, but generally, if I just take your liver, Peter, and just take one of the cells out, the chances are that you feel so lonely that it just said, no, I'm just going to commit suicide.
A bacteria can okay.
Well, I mean, eventually I'll give you chapter and verse, but I haven't put chapter and verse because this is a talk.
Yeah.
So, the evolution of apoptosis in multicellular eukaryotes, our sort of organisms, is relatively simple to envisage. By the way, there are other ways you can induce it to do it, but that's one way. Okay, because, you know, it's to repair damage and all the rest of it. But the real exciting moment of apoptosis research came in 1995 when this guy working in Paris discovered that single-cell eukaryotes, amoebas, the amoebas of the world, they can commit suicide. Now that's harder. How does the trait that says you can commit suicide get passed on? But at least at first sight, that's kind of a pretty stupid thing to do. And how can committing suicide help you make more babies? You know, it doesn't seem immediately obvious. So, this is a knowledgeable audience, so I don't have to do this, but eukaryotes are the ones with nuclei, prokaryotes, bacteria are the ones without nuclei. So it turns out that program cell has also now been described in bacteria. So in other words, the message is that, oh, by the way, the mitochondria, you all know the mitochondria used to be a bacterium, and not surprisingly, in fact, the mitochondrion is one of the major initiators of PCD. If you do things to the cell to initiate, to commit cell suicide, the signals originally come from the mitochondrion. The message here is everybody does it. I mean, it's, you know, multicellular, unicellular, unicellular, prokaryotes, unicellular, eukaryotes, everybody does it. There's no escape. All cells, on all levels, know and love committing suicide. So then you need to explain this, because, you know, how does life ever get started if there are traits that tell you you can commit suicide? Oh, by the way, it turns out, if you're one kind of biologist, when you discover a new trait, you say, what molecules do it? Once you say what molecules do it, you say what genes do it. Once you have what genes do it, you say delete them. Well, that's the usual reductive, totally reductive, quite literally reductionist program. You know, just get rid of it, see what happens. It turns out you can't. At least in all the cases that I've read up, and again, there are probably exceptions, but in all the ones that I've read up, the molecules that do death, in other words, they feature in the death pathway, they find a life function for it too. In other words, the thing is crosstalk to maximum degree. You can't just get rid of it because I do something else. So what that tells me, at least, and I think there is some there's some feeling out there that because everybody does it and the molecules are deeply embedded in doing both, it probably goes back to, this is not the Italian tongue, very nice too, but this, that's two A's, two C's, but this is large universal common ancestor and the first thing that is the thing that we call a cell. So my guess is that cellular suicide was deeply embedded enough that it probably went all the way back to Luca. Luca probably did suicide. That's the Occam's razor interpretation of the current evidence. So PCD may well be very ancient and deeply embedded. So how did it evolve? But of course, you know, when we say LUCA, we have this idea of one cell wearing a t-shirt saying, I am the first cell. You know, but there's no such thing. I mean, I'm the first cell in a soup of other cells that are probably approximately the same. In other words, life would have evolved single cells, but in an environment of a colony of it. It's never going to be just, I am the first cell monad in the universe, I'm the one and only cell in the world. And you know, Darwinian evolution doesn't work on single cells, they work in communities. Okay? So, in fact, it turns out that what it does is it enables cannibalism in populations under stress. So that's certainly how you can induce it in single cells. Hello? Just taking an answer. He decided to do what I did in Prabhu's seminar. Oh no, he's awake. Prabhu, you're allowed to fall asleep in my talk, by the way. just go for it. Right. So, I mean, the point is this. Here's a symbolic representation. I mean, once you write it this way, it begins to look like physics. At least it looks like chemistry. It's just going up the scale. When you have arrows like that, it looks like chemistry. Right, okay, so you start with some little things and you build up into big things. Biologists call this anabolism and this is catabolism. So these sort of processes we kind of understand reasonably well. It's biochemistry, you know, we can figure this out. But this process is kind of a bit like programmed cell death. It breaks it back down to bits. And you notice I've written the bits not the same as A, B, C, D. I've written P, Q, R, and that's deliberate. Because these need not be the same as those. Okay, that need not be the same. Oh, by the way, you know, even this, if this goes wrong, there are already plenty of diseases, let alone this. Okay? So every time there's a backwards arrow, things go wrong, leads to disease. And the point is, there's always selection pressure. And the point is that not all PQRs are equivalent. So, you know, what I should have written down is also possibly go down to P prime, Q prime, R prime. And let me give you an example of that. So this is like, you know, I drew it this way because I want to say biology basically looks like circular economy. Biologists have been doing it for a long time. Let me show you this paper. This paper deserves to be in the front cover of Nature and a special issue on its own, but of course being Nature, I don't think they published it. That's why they sent it to American Naturalist. There is such a journal. What's his name? Stephen Jay Gould published in American Naturalist quite a lot, so did Simon Connery Morris. So it's a perfectly serious journal, but I think it's an incredibly exciting paper. What I did was this. They took a bunch of algae, Chlamydomonas. There is a good use of Chlamydomonas without doing pullers. You know, there is a second use for Chlamydomonas. It's very important. You know, your kind of stuff. You know, this stuff. Now, there's one puller and lots of pushers in the world. And you know, this is the second use for the one puller that I can think of. So this is very good. There's 100% increase in the use of Chlamydomonas. Right, so what you do is you put in two test tubes. One of them is you just kill them. I can't remember how they did it, some nasty way. Ultrasound, and then did something. The other tube, they induce it to commit suicide. Put under mild stress. They spin the cells down, take the supernatant off. This is the growth of the cell in its normal growth medium. Number, log of the number of cells proportional to, and time. This is the normal growth medium, the thing that you mix up to grow the cells. This is the supernatant from the tube that has committed suicide. This is the supernatant from the tube that has been killed violently. I think everything you need to know is there. It has evolved to do a job. So in other words, if you're under nutrient stress, if some of the cells commit suicide, it enables others to live. And live better, actually, than when you started. It knows precisely what it's doing. Which screw to unscrew and which screw to leave on to make it as good as it comes.
So what's being measured?
Just growth as against time. Number of cells, log of number of cells against time. It grows at the same rate, but to a higher capacity. This one almost doesn't grow. So in other words, the product, the debris from... Yes, ma'am.
So it's almost like pruning of fruit, right? So you take some blossom away, so the other fruit...
Except that you don't immediately use the thing you're taking off to feed the other... I mean, you don't immediately use it for a mulch. Even if you do, it's not going to feed back in time. This is real-time cannibalism. I mean, this is the real thing. Cell eat cell. I mean,
so this is a clonal population, right?
I mean, sorry, clonal.
Nominally genetically identical.
and possibly even really genetically identical. I mean, the evolution lifetime of Clemmermonas is much longer than bacteria. And so, you know, 6 days is not going to give you a frog out of it. I mean, yeah, not really. I mean, really, yeah, Nobel Prize if it does. But, right, anyway, what was I going to say? I've forgotten. You threw me. you use a biology word, you said clonal. That completely threw me. What was I going to tell you? I forgot what I was going to tell you. But what I'm saying is, actually, going back to my previous slide, you know, this is disassembling into PQR, this is disassembling into P prime, Q prime, R prime. They're not the same. Not every way of breaking something down is equally good. If you know what good means, and good means feeding back. So the moment you have a target function, you can say it's good or bad. Okay? So that's death, that's programmed cell death. There is an axis, I mean, it's wonderful to be talking to physicists because I can say the following without explaining it. There's another axis that is linearly independent but not orthogonal, and that's growing old. When the probability of death doesn't need to be linear with age. I mean, if you happen to live through the First World War, the probability of death is a massive peak when you're about, you know, 18 to 25, and then it goes down again. So, you know, it's environment dependent and all the rest of it. So, you know, this is a linearly independent axis, but it's clearly not independent of programmed cell death. And, you know, what detailed relationships are being worked out, but I just want to show you one slide that's, you know, I mean, this is a log of body mass, this is the lifetime in number of heartbeats, and, you know, going from hamster to whale, going through us, we're depressingly the same as everything else. So, you know, there is a built-in T-naught. I mean, the most depressing definition of the midlife crisis was given to me by a theorist that you all know, this is Thomas Cliche. He and I had our midlife crisis together in the same bar. We just decided when we were 40, meeting in a bar, that we're going to have our midlife crisis right now. So we're going to have a midlife crisis.
Yes.
So we're competing to come up with definitions, and Tom trumped me completely by saying, midlife crisis is when you suddenly realize that time is now order one. This is order one. Sorry. Anyway, so there is order one time, that's the point. And order one time in the suitable units is identical for all mammals. So there are processes that are built in that says, you know, that's the way it goes. But it's not the same as PCD, but it cannot be orthogonal. Details are being worked out. And in fact, it turns out that latest results again from France, single cell death seems to be a French thing. Even bacteria seem to be mortal. So in other words, even bacteria appear to be not able to divide forever and ever, even if the environment is perfect. Even they accumulate faults. So, all of that is on the cell level. Let me give you one slide descending down to the molecular level to show you that there are the sort of commonality the physicists look for before they get interested. So I've written that. I said that is little things that I assemble all the way up to the level of cells, but on single level molecules, I mean, those are amino acids, those are proteins. You don't have to go all the way to the cell. Okay? Now, why did I show you that slide? That's because this process is actually constantly occurring in our cells. In the yeast cell, a resting yeast cell, budding yeast, the sort of thing that people do if they don't do E. coli or Clemmermonas, about 50% of its maintenance energy, minimum energy that it needs, is spent on just treadmilling this thing. I mean, to the physicists encountering this for the first time, this seems incredibly stupid. I mean, 50% of your energy is a lot of your energy. And you use it to just make amino acids and say, in the protein and say, let's see, just for fun, I'm going to chop them up again so that I can do it again. You know, we used to make prisoners do that in prisons, but actually, even they don't glue the stones back together to make big stones. But, you know, I mean, this treadmilling seems incredibly stupid. But then you think about it, you know, in engineering, you bias a transistor up to mid-level so that it can act as an amplifier. So, in embryogenesis, you build the thing up and then you chop it back out again. Here, you treadmill the proteins. RNA is exactly the same. DNA, by the way, is not. DNA lasts basically forever. But there are a few proteins. So the average lifetime of a protein in a yeast cell is something like minutes. In humans, it can be days. But in humans, there are one or two proteins that last our lifetime. And those proteins are associated with aging, it turns out. Isn't that interesting? The ones that escape this thing controls the T-naught. So, I mean, the two things are related. But treadmilling, extending energy to disassemble and reassemble again, seemed to be the way biology actually tunes system levels. So biology uses it to tune the level of a protein. You change the rates of these two, act, both consume ATP, both are active processes. So treadmilling again. So let's compare. Let's compare. So biology has a senescence. Engineering has gone through a building obsolescence from light bulbs to iPhones. Biology has programmed cell death. Engineering is talking about active disassembly. Biology has natural selection. Engineering, if you want to do circular economy, you better start thinking about which ways of ripping it apart is better than other ways. You know, they're thinking it. They don't call it natural selection because it's not natural, but it's selection. So the question is, where is physics? I mean, we don't like being left behind by engineers and biologists, right? I mean, it's humiliating. Can't do. Won't do. Will not do. Right. Okay. So, some metaphysicists of our kind have been talking about self-assembly for absolutely as long as I can remember. It turns out that the term is as old as me. I'll show you in a moment. So, it's all inspired by biology and by physics, and it's this stuff. It's anabolism. We're quite good at thinking about this. We're even thinking about active self-assembly nowadays. So it turns out that, as far as I know, and I was first alerted to this by Vindam and O'Haran, and my checking so far has not produced anything earlier, it's used by these two physicists, he later got a Nobel Prize, for working on the structure of tobacco mosaic virus. In this paper in 1962, and now I'm going to tell you my age, that's the year I was born, Physical Principles and Construction of Regular Viruses. And here is the birth of the term self-assembly. It's used by physicists to talk biology. But notice, this is only just biology. It's a virus. That's because virus really can do it entirely by Brownian motion. Virus really can do it entirely by self-assembly, by passive self-assembly. Virus does not need to do disassembly. Actually, for me, that disqualifies from to be just on that side of life, because all the other life processes that I know actually need disassembly to function. This one doesn't need to assemble, you just throw it in, KT does it. So, you know, I mean, the rest is familiar to this audience. People can now do, well, this is fantastic. This is not the process. This is not, there's a cleverer bit than that. Some of you might have seen this. So Scripps used to sell this, now the website says we're sold out, go away. It's very annoying.
What is this?
Just bits of Lego that they design. So if you shake
this
it.
This is active discipline of shaking, by the
way. It's active, it's totally active.
Not
That's
a one-way energy flux here.
Yes.
Well, we all need one, right? But just they've sold out, and they refuse to make any more. I mean,
we have a bunch of random.
They're just little pieces that they design so that if there's agitation, they will self-assemble. This is self-assembly. So, you know, people can make increasingly sophisticated particles with engineered interactions to make superstructures, this is simulations, this is using DNA on the particles, memory program people have written on, you know, using, making living matter towards using colloidal particles. I'm 100% sure that this program will fail. 100% sure. I'm seldom stated in scientific talks. And that's because real living matter, for real living matter, self-assembly is half the story. All living matter that I know, apart from viruses, which I don't count, have disassembly coupled in. It seems that life can't do without always treadmilling this disassembly stuff from molecules to cells. But when you stop that, the thing stops. So I think if we really want to self-assemble a frog, we can't just do the physics of self-assembly. I think we absolutely need to nuclear the physics of disassembly and couple it at the same time to the physics of self-assembly. I mean, just assembly is not very interesting. Okay. So, I mean, this is the kind of convergence I'm talking about. You build it up, you can disassemble it. So the question is, what is the equivalent for physics research? This is biology, this is engineering, and there's also selection in both. So that's the question. So, you know, this is self-assembly, so self-disassembly. What is the equivalent in the physics thing? So PCD seems to be deeply embedded. Circular economy thinking must be embedded into design thinking. So I would claim that if we actually learn to embed self-disassembly thinking into the general soft matter area, it would actually completely transform the subject. Because it's going to be exactly like a mere bottle. If you think self-assembly and think self-disassembly at the same time, it would change the way you think about self-assembly in the first place. And so, for example, at the moment, to design self-assembly of a structure, you have to work very hard. You have to work very hard. That's why you publish Nature papers on it. Okay? So, but the way the cell does it, you know, DNA self-assembly makes mistakes all the time, but it expends energy to do error correction. That disassembly is very expensive energy. Let it go do it. But if it's wrong, I cut it out and do it again. That's the same with microtubules. Okay, so if you have active disassembly, you think about self-assembly in a totally different way. That's the same sentence. I wonder why I changed it again. Oh yes, oh yes. So I think actually if we work out the physics of death, it would actually transform the way we think about the physics of life. In other words, the physics of life need to include, necessarily include the physics of death. If we don't put the death bit in, we will never build a frog. I don't know why I'm obsessed with frogs. It's because we hear frogs in the residence all night. Right. And I wouldn't mind betting quite a lot of beer that we need a new kind of STATMAC to do this. I mean, we need a new STATMAC to do active self-assembly. How do we talk about this stuff all coupled together? It's definitely we need to new synthetic chemistry because we'll do things totally differently. And what's the last point here? There's one more point. Oh yeah, and it actually may enable us to talk to the economists, you know, because they are modeling these things. They are drawing network diagrams. They are talking about costs for cost with dissipation. You know, how do you actually do all that? Are there any generic principles to make disassembly so ubiquitous for all levels of life? So, you know, being of Chinese extraction, I have to draw this diagram. So, you know, I mean, the life-death thing is not nearly as face-separated as you think. It seems that life processes have the death thing embedded into it at all levels. And I think once those three things come together, it will be absolutely incredibly powerful. So I hope I persuaded all of you to drop everything that you currently do and work on death instead. Thanks.
Have a powerful force for disassembly, and that's Brownian motion. I mean, that kicks things apart, right? If manipulated correctly with attraction.
What you said is obvious.
So she's saying the problem is solved. We have Brownian motion. We understand it.
You can go and assemble your frog thinking about just self-assembly using Brownian motion. I mean, it's 19th century physics. It's called the equilibrium constant. K1, K2, K1 over K2 log is the equilibrium constant. We understand that, but that's not active disassembly. Biology bothers to spend ATP to take the cell apart. Biology to spend ATP to take proteins apart that it just spend ATP making. Why does it bother to do that? Because it can't do it with just Brownian motion. So there is physics there that is definitely beyond Brownian motion. So if you just let microtubules assemble, they assemble full of defects everywhere. They go from 14 to 13 quite often. Brownian motion does not disassemble it to anneal the defects out because there's an equilibrium constant of defects. What it does is expend energy to cut those things out and rebuild it. That's the active bit. So yes, thermodynamics 101 can get you so far. But you do need something more.
You could say that the processes that life uses to decide to adapt are necessarily exponentially growing. So it's a little bit more adaptive and it finds something good to do and it grows exponentially. But you can't manage a steady, exponential growth is not compatible with a steady state. So it wants to reap the benefits of this advantage and establish a steady state.
So what you're saying...
What you need, the way you could imagine that, since you're competing with exponential growth, something just as powerful to block the exponential growth.
I mean, what you're saying is, you know, you know, logistic equation, no, nn minus 1, right? It's nn minus 1, n minus 1, right? I mean, just as or is it 1 minus n? Just as this term does not stop the entire program of the physics of self-assembly, that other bit doesn't stop you building a program of actually understanding it. Yeah, sure. I mean, everything I said is in the logistic equation in some sense. But
this doesn't make it stay safe. It makes chaos.
No, not a single D like that.
This is D by D. This is not integer. This is not integer.
I think I understand what you're saying. All processes, I don't know if it's this. All processes in the cell, or many, many processes, are autocatalytic.
Mm-hmm.
We have more of A, you build more of A.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's unsustainable. And therefore, when you build A, you have to degrade A.
Yes, and the crucial part of our life is it's not a steady state. The thing is called evolution. It has a direction. It travels. Life is not a steady state. The crucial thing about here is the mutation.
This process is cyclic. That you build something, you degrade it, and unless you degrade it, you will die. So you have to degrade what you build.
But that only asks you to degrade back to exactly the same set every time.
No,
but the moment it isn't, then it's not trivial. The moment you have to select what's the best screws to take out.
That's what you wrote down.
You
go from proteins to amino acids, not to...
That's why it is not a trivial matter of conservation of mass. Because what you're saying is that, you know, you have to die to come back. That's just because life in the end is canonical in immaterial, although it is grand canonical in energy. But it's canonical in materials. So it's, of course, you have to loop back. That's true. But that doesn't necessarily say that that doesn't give you a means of saying what is the better way of disassembling than others. But that LG experiment tells you that there really are better ways of disassembling than others. So the question is, what's the narrative to think through that? No, the program without evolution is utterly trivial. This is a biophysics problem where if you don't put evolution in, then it is actually trivial. The moment you put evolution in, it's non-trivial. Which makes it a good biophysics problem, because there are very few biophysics problems of which you can say evolution can't wait. Most biophysicists, most of the time, do their biophysics without taking a single bit of notice of evolution. Which actually means it is not actually doing biophysics properly. It may be the physics of biomolecules, but it's not physics of life, actually. Dobzhensky, etc. Someone this side needs to have some fun. Let them have all the fun. It's not yet biscuits, but I mean, I'm happy to finish it. Okay.
When did evolution come into your argument? I understand.
Yeah, I think, Wilson, it would actually help if in this, I mean, you go back to history. It's true that your last picture with Luca had evolution written in it, but it wasn't actually clear from this.
The products of disassembly have to be useful, that is the important
thing. That's right.
It has to loop back, but no. I mean, that bit is in here.
That's not evolution.
Yeah, I mean, there are many possibilities, and you choose the one that is beneficial.
That is...
It's in this graph.
It's
which
PQR,
it's
yeah.
But that's fitness.
Yes.
You have to think
yes.
about evolution to think about fitness.
Because you don't have to think about mutation.
You do. These processes have rates and it's in a fixed resource environment. Then some processes would just go away if you don't make babies well enough.
Right. But it's competition before it's evolution, I guess is what.
The burden of Darwin's book is to say those two things are the same. The same enough to, you know, you can't have one without the other. So that is the crucial sentence. But I don't quite know how to draw it in my picture. If you can think of a good way of drawing this, I'm perfectly happy to include it. But I do want a symbolic thing to summarize this whole thing.
So going back to your virus, the reason you don't like it is because those things often disassemble and assemble, but it's purely static.
Is K1 over K2,
yeah.
You know, yeah,
yeah
sure,
not
I mean, you know, Harbour understood that, so that's okay.
experiment you're talking about, where when the cells die naturally, then it, the remaining ones in a better environment. That has been repeated in other contexts also, or is it?
I don't know why more people don't do experiments on that kind of thing. I'm currently redoing that experiment for prokaryotes. In other words, I'm trying to do it for bacteria. See what it's the same in bacteria. So that one was done with algae and higher eukaryotic cells. Because I have a feeling that is not the same in bacteria.
That would have relevance to what you're talking about.
It indeed does have relevance to what I talk about. But I have a feeling that it isn't, because one of the stupid things I've ever done, but now I'm glad I've done it. It's the first bacteria experiment I ever done. Actually, it was done by my postdoc, but I just didn't stop him. He grew bacteria in distilled water, which is a pretty sad thing to do. It's the sort of thing physicists would do, because distilled water is clean. I know what's in there. But it turns out that after about a month, there's still bacteria in there. I was really surprised. And that's because, in fact, the first few exploded under osmotic pressure, and obviously the rest can eat the, I mean, it doesn't last forever, but it lasted for much more than a month.
So what happens to DNA within itself? Does that get broken down to nucleic acids?
I don't know the details. I have not looked into details about DNA. I thought much more about protein.
Is there a machinery in the cell to break down nucleic acids?
DNA, I think, lasts for a long time.
I know it does. But
RNA, I think so.
No, RNA certainly goes down nucleic acid and get recycled, yes. Absolutely.
DNA polymerase. That's me. But I'm asking about breaking it down.
Yeah, helicase. Helicase does this. No, but every enzyme works in both ways. Polymerase also depolymerize if you tune the conditions, necessarily.
So, cell scavengers in a way, scrap of DNA, dead cells that have been taken apart.
So, the generic principle there is, if you look at both DNA and RNA, in the disassembly, there's an active part and there's a passive part. The active part is mechanical. It unfolds the globular protein and unwinds the RNA. Thereafter, it does thermodynamics, sort of one big, Michaelis-Menten kinetics.
During apoptosis, does the DNA get disassembled at that same time?
What amazed me is I can't find a single paper where they put the apoptosis product through a mass spec. Because, these guys do mass spec all the time.
Or just put some marker in to see if you can.
So, I mean, this is the first time in my life that I find myself wanting to do mass spec. That's saying quite a lot. I mean, it's, you have to go take me a long way down an interesting problem before I wish I could do mass spec. But no, I think that's crying out loud to be done. It seems to ask, what is it about the debris, at least in that experiment? But that experiment itself is somewhat controversial, because you have to be sure that you are killing them differently, and you're sure you induce apoptosis. But it seems that it's not grossly controversial. A lot of people are prepared to think, that may well be true, because the result makes some sense. Doesn't mean it's, and it's not. They have done one more experiment, and no one has followed it up, because apparently studying death is not, except in cancer, of course, because evading, PCD is, in that context, it is very popular. This is drug targets and things, right? But yes, I agree that the algae experiment is incredibly thought-provoking.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.